This is a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat with guest Robbie Faulks. I'm your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond. For the best in Americana, alt country, indie rock, and more, point your browser to nosurfmusic.com. This is another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammond, and joining me today is Robbie Faulks. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. All right. Well, it's good to have you back in Cleveland. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been, two, 3 years, something like that.
Okay.
2-3 years.
I know the last time I saw you was actually, we're at the Beachland today, where you're going to be doing a show at the Tavern. Mm-hmm. But the last time I saw you was actually over on the ballroom side, and it was right after Revenge came out, I think. So that's been a good, 5 years or so, something like that?
Boy, yeah, something, maybe longer. Yeah.
Well, it's definitely been a while, so I'm glad to have you back here and supporting a brand new album. And what's the name of the album?
Gone Away Backward.
Okay, and we're definitely going to talk about that because it's an interesting one. But just so folks get an idea in case they don't know you, you have been a stalwart in the sort of alt-country Americana world for a long time. Your first solo album was 1996, right, with Country Love Songs?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And you started out with Bloodshots, and you've kind of been on again, off again, and you're back with them now for this album, right?
Right, yeah.
So what do you think about sort of being back home with them? Has it been a good fit, and are you enjoying working with them again?
Oh, yeah, I am. So far, so good. And, I mean, the record's only really been out a couple of weeks, so it's kind of a new thing. But we're all friends by now, and, we got to be friends in the 90s and never really fell out of touch. And so it doesn't really feel like, it's not really like going back to high school when you're 30, you know. It's not that kind of deal. It's more like just... it's more continuous with what I've been doing than that.
Okay, I gotcha. And I guess one of the things that you are most famous for is a real contempt for the way that country music has gone over the last couple of decades. And I think Bloodshot is one of the labels that kind of is standing against that, which might be why you're a good fit. But that whole thing is sort of exemplified in my mind by your song Fuck This Town, which is a personal favorite. I've always loved it.
Thank you.
And I'm actually going down to Nashville next week to work on a few stories. So can you just give us an idea, what is it about, you know, the modern country scene that really gets in your craw? What is the problem that you see?
Well, I can tell you what it was, but okay. It's been quite a while since those days. I had a deal on Music Row from 93 to 98, I guess. I worked down there on the row as a songwriter, and so in the midst of that was when, you know, I did Fuck This Town that you're talking about. So that's quite a while ago, and I really haven't paid that much attention to it since being immersed in it. But at the time, what was going on was Garth Brooks had recently reached a great sales height of 14 million records with his record No Fences. And all of a sudden, just because of the way the industry works, you know, that or any other, you know, that was the new standard, not only in terms of sales, but in terms of style. So people were looking for stuff that reflected those themes, which were kind of, I don't know, to me, kind of quasi-feminist themes, songs about, songs for female audiences, which is what they thought was their core audience, were like a little bit older and women. And so, you know, for me as a songwriter, I came down there to write songs kind of with the themes that I like, which are drunkenness and despair and, you know, like the older themes, you know, not all negative, but a lot of negative themes. And all of a sudden, like, negative themes were taboo, and it was all positive, and it was kind of like mushy, and you could write, I mean, if you wrote a negative song, it'd be about a woman killing her husband and learning a positive life lesson or something.
Okay.
But it was just so totally not what I was about or interested in. And it was the sort of, you know, it was the reigning and only model for those years. After I left, like, Shania came along, and then after that, you know, it's, I'm not sure where it's at now, but it seems to me like there are a lot more things that are sayable. You know, like when I was doing it, you couldn't mention a woman's body parts, or at least, you know, my bosses, you know, told me that I shouldn't write about that, and you couldn't, you couldn't sort of resolve a song without people learning a positive thing about how to live, all these bullshit things. And
so nobody dies a drunk. They always end up in rehab, right?
Yeah. But it seemed like after I left, like Shania Twain, I actually liked some of these fun and light and stupid, you know, and I liked some of her stuff. And Toby Keith had stuff that he has just songs about bars and songs that are just kind of like in your face with their silliness and the earthiness or whatever. And that's the kind of, that's some of the stuff that I like about country music. So it seems more open now.
Okay. So is that sort of why you decided to go your own way and do the sort of semi-independence kind of...
Well, I didn't really decide anything for the last, you know, 50 years that I've been alive. In the case of music, you know, I was just looking for a way to do something that I was good at doing and get paid for it, really. And hopefully, you know, the apex would be to make records under your own name and put them out and have an audience and have people buy them. And that sort of pretty much happened for me, so I think it worked out well for me in the end. But, you know, on the way there, I had this job writing country songs, and then, you know, Bloodshot, that was a label that was interested in putting out my stuff, so I delivered them stuff that was suitable for that, and then I worked for other labels since, and sort of, you know, I didn't, like, carve my thing into whatever shape, you know, somebody wanted, but... You know, depending on who's putting out your stuff, they're interested in different aspects of what you do. So I just kind of rolled with the opportunities that came my way. I didn't really, like, you know, I probably had a master plan, but it didn't work out according to it.
I gotcha. But at the same time, musically, I think that you've gotten the opportunity to go your own way a lot. I mean, your early albums... were sort of a very specific kind of alt country, more on the alt side, if you know what I mean, more rock than country sometimes, kind of a feel. You've always sort of had that country rock thing going on, but you've also experimented here and there. I mean, your 13 Hillbilly Giants record was all covers of classic country. And then Happy, which was recently, was a Michael Jackson tribute, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also Couples in Trouble stands out as being just completely not at all country, essentially.
There's some country on it, but I think I'm mostly a country performer. I mean, I think 75% of what I've done has been just plain old country music. And whether it's called alternative or not, I mean, I don't know. That's not really a term with a fixed meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it means that it's country music that won't be played on country stations, so my stuff is definitely that. And, you know, and then just because it's aware that it's not stuff that's going to be played on country stations, it tends to affect the musical presentation as far as, you know, people feel free to cuss and people feel free to make it sound rougher and rawer than it would otherwise be, and I felt free to do all that stuff. So the freedom that you get by not being popular, I've tried to exploit, you know, and it's like a real advantage of it, you know. I mean, it's a hardship not being popular in a lot of ways, you know. It's like, you know, I do my own driving and book a lot of my own shows and, you know, do a lot of stuff that more popular guys don't have to do. But the great, great advantage of it is that I can, you know, if I feel like making such and such a record, I can just sort of save up money and make it, and I don't have this, like, infrastructure of advisors around me sort of like advising me to do this or not to do that. I feel like that's an advantage when I talk to other people that are more famous than I am and that are a lot more pressured, and I don't like the pressure. I felt a little bit of it at different points in my thing, and it's not for me. I would rather be a lone wolf and doing it cheaply and on my own.
I gotcha. Well, it definitely seems like, you know, just as I said, you've been able to sort of turn on a dime and kind of do what you've wanted to do, change style or whatever it is. And I think you did that again this time with the new record, Gone Away Backward. And just so folks know, it is actually the September featured review for 2013 on the No Surf Review.
On No Surf, all right,
indeed.
No Surf.
So if you haven't heard of it yet, go ahead and check it out, and you can hear what I have to say and hear a couple tracks on there. So it's a very interesting album. But in order to talk about it, I think we kind of even have to go further back to get there, because it is a huge stylistic change from your normal sort of alt-country feel. Because it's almost entirely old-school kind of bluegrassy stuff, right?
I guess so. I mean, not to beat a dead horse, but I don't think of myself as alt country, and mm-hmm. I don't even really know what it means. So I kind of do what I want to do and think of it as country. And the new thing is like acoustic country music, really.
Okay.
And I tried to do something that was that referred to bluegrass. That hinted at it pretty strongly. I mean, a couple of the tunes just are bluegrass. There's banjo on it, you know, played Scrugg style on two of the songs. But most of it kind of like refers to it without being it, you know. Most of it, and some of it refers to like pre-bluegrass acoustic country music, mm-hmm. like the Monroe Brothers played, or like the Delmores played. And I love that music, and I've played, I flat picked and played fiddle tunes all my life. And in the few years before I put out this record, or before I made the record, I made it in 2011, I was, just by happenstance, I was working more with people in duo and trio formats and playing into microphones and doing this thing that I used to do when I was like 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And really finding that I love doing that. And I love doing it more than what I had been doing, which is playing with drum kits and electric guitars and stuff. So it seemed like that was where my heart was kind of headed at this stage of the game. So I thought I'd, make a group of songs around that idea.
Okay. And I thought the title in particular was spot on, because you really did start out sort of more in that vein, kind of like you just hinted, when you were 10. You started playing banjo pretty early on, right?
I started banjo at 7, and I started guitar at 11, and I played other things along the way, but I figured out somewhere that guitar was really my thing, and I mostly just stick to that.
Okay. And you were with a bluegrass band for a while, right? Special
yeah,
Consensus, is
that's
that correct?
Right.
And that was before your solo career. So
it was in the 80s, yeah.
So you've got a background in that, so it's not a complete change for you.
No, but I've been doing it all along, and I think every one of my records has a bluegrass tune on it. Like the very best has an actual Special Consensus song on it.
Mm-hmm.
South Mouth has a South Richmond Girl on it. I think most of them have some bluegrass on them.
Okay. I also saw some major changes thematically and lyrically on this album from what you usually
You're
do.
Really listening.
I try to. I don't know. I've been a fan of yours for quite a while, and a lot of the songs that you're best known for are less serious, shall we say. Mm-hmm. Kind of spoofy songs, something in the vein of Roger Miller, kind of, I think
right.
of them. And you've certainly had a lot of serious songs as well. In particular, I always think of Georgia Heart as kind of your masterpiece song that respect. Well, I definitely dig it. But I guess this album was kind of like Georgia Hard to the extreme, just over and over again. You were in that serious mode. You didn't have any real sort of jokey songs on it. Was that meant to be that way, or did it just kind of fall into place like that?
The non-jokiness, I don't know. I'm older now than then. I don't know if people want to see like a 60-year-old guy. I'm not 60, but, I'm headed there. I don't know if people want to see a 60-year-old guy, doing jokey songs about death. Because, he's going to die soon. I don't know if want like jokey sex songs. I mean, a lot of the subjects for jokes,
right.
I think, are different when you're singing as an old man. And since I'm headed there, I'm 50 now, it seems like it's a...
I don't know. I'm going to take you home and make you like B-Works as a midlife crisis song, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's jokey songs on Georgia Hard, for sure.
Right.
That was, like, 2005. And I love writing, like, humorous songs. I don't think I'll ever stop doing it. But I definitely... there's definitely a self-censoring impulse now when it comes to performing them. Because, as you say, like, I think I've been over... recognized for that element of what I do,
mm-hmm.
If there's two funny songs on a record out of 12, people will focus on that to the detriment of everything else, and it seems like it sort of bleeds into and stains all the other material on the record, he's a comic, he's a fucking cut-up,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden it's a cut-up act when it's really not. So, I think I can fashion a good, compelling record without any jokey material, I guess I did try to do that in this new one.
Yeah, well, I think you definitely accomplished it this time around. Although I do have to say, I totally get what you're saying there, but I think it's also a compliment to how good you are when you do those wittier songs, that they are the ones that stick in people's minds as well.
You know? People either like them the best or hate them the most, and there's not a lot of in between on them, you know, like. But on the new one, I mean, there's a similar dynamic at work on the new one, because people either, depending on where they are in terms of liking country music or liking sort of something alternative to country music, they either, there's a song on there called That's Where I'm From, that's just kind of a heartfelt country song, and it's sentimental, even like almost maudlin in places. And so, you know, if people don't like plain old country music, they might like all the record except for that song. And on the other hand, there's a sort of more adventurous experimental song called The Many Disguises of God, which straight down their middle country people have objected to. So I see the reviews, and people are often giving it B pluses on the basis that they can accept all of the record except for that one song, whichever the two it is.
I gotcha. You know? Well, that's kind of what happens when you go your own way, like we were talking before. I mean, you're never going to make anybody happy because you're trying to make yourself happy with what you're doing, right?
I try to make the records coherent, and I try to think, like, what's from here to here, and where's A and where's point B, and, you know, so that the record has a consistent personality. So I think I might have failed in the case of this record, because it might go one song too far off the spectrum.
Okay, well, I mean, I think you kind of captured sort of the two ends of the spectrum on the album. Pretty well there, but I actually think they fit together pretty well. I mean, you have to be an accepting listener. You have to not come to it with preconceptions. But I think if you do that, it all makes sense to me personally. Maybe I'm just as crazy as you are. Who the hell knows? But
that could be.
Anything is possible. But let's talk about a couple more of the songs on the album, just to give people an idea. But before we do that, I think we do need to talk about the song Georgia Heart just a little bit, because I see that, like I said, as kind of a precursor to this album. So that was a sort of a semi-autobiographical song. Can you tell us how you got started writing that one? And
you know, I think I was listening to a lot of Don Williams and stuff like that, 70s country music, and so I'm trying to get that gentle, loping kind of sound along with a gentle, rueful kind of a narrator, kind of that voice. And I don't know, autobiography is something that, like, you know, I've avoided in the past, and now I tend to exploit it more. I think if people sense that you're telling about, that you're using details from your own experience, that it hits a little harder sometimes, and I think maybe I can sing it a little bit better if those details are in there. So, you know, a lot of times, like in the case of that song, the framework will be kind of fictional. You know, it's a guy from Georgia, where I'm not from, and he's like, I think he's taking the bus up to the city to move, and he's working on a pecan plantation or something in Georgia. So all these things, like, I didn't do, but I did move to Chicago from the South, and I did follow a girl up there, and she did break up with me. So it's kind of like half and half, and hopefully it'll resonate more.
Okay. Well, in that respect, I think I kind of see two songs in particular as being the successors to Georgia Heart on the new album. The first one is Sometimes the Grass is Really Greener, and that has a lot of the same autobiographical elements in it, right?
It's almost too samey, yeah. I'm singing them both in my set this week and last, and I'm feeling the sameness of a couple of these songs. I mean, I put out like 12 records or something now, and it's, you know, out of, you know, 140 songs or whatever it is, there are a couple that kind of cover the same territory a little bit too much. But Grass is Really Greener, yeah, similar story. Guy is, he's a bluegrass musician. He leaves the farm in Virginia. He goes to New York. I mean, it's different cities, but it's kind of...
Well, I think it's got that same migrants thing, but what's interesting to me
is it's not a girl. It's not a romantic
song.
Right.
It's more about the musician part of you than the other part that you covered in Georgia Hard, the more personal stuff.
Right. He gets his butt kicked by the music industry, and then he comes crawling back home.
So it's got a little bit of Fuck This Town in there, too,
I guess. Got a little bit of, Fuck New York. It's not, like, satirical or angry or anything like Fuck This Town was. And it's not really my story. It's a little bit based on this group, the Gibson Brothers, that were telling me about how they came to Nashville and people started dicking with their sound and stuff. And so it's as much about them as it is about me, I think.
Okay. Okay. And then the other one that I saw sort of parallels to the song Georgia Hard was the one you mentioned, I believe, earlier, That's Where I'm From.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, that one is sort of the same kind of a migrant's tale. I kind of saw, I guess, a little bit of Woody Guthrie feeling in there, kind of the Okie migration feeling, a little bit of... sort of almost the Irish potato famine kind of everybody's going to America kind of laments and all of that. But that's really about almost an economic transition as much as a geographical one, right? And about people sort of pulling themselves up and moving away from their roots.
Yeah, it's a guy coming from rural poverty, like improving his lot, getting a good job. He ends up in the suburbs, he's raising kids, and all of a sudden he's looking back at where he came from, which he always kind of hated and felt scarred by. But he's actually looking back with a little bit of sweetness because his kids are kind of like divorced from his own reality. And, you know, I read somebody writing about it say that he, you know, it's too late he realizes that he is what he left behind, and I think that's a good way to sum it up. I thought that was like a pungent way to do it, and yeah, I mean, that theme is pretty personal for me because that's kind of what happened to me, and you know, we didn't grow up as poor as that guy in the song, but you know, the goat is from my family, so I put some details from our farm into it. And I'm not white collar, so the extremes in my life aren't as extreme as presented in that song, but the sort of basic story is the same. And I think that dislocated feeling that you get, you know, at the time when I was a kid, we moved around every year. We were living in a different place, you know, different small town or farmhouse, And then I just moved to the big city, and I've been there ever since I was old enough to, like, be on my own. I just left, and, like, act two of the life begins there. And I was very happy to get away and happy to be self-sufficient, and I love cities. But yeah, at this age, it's funny that those memories, like, kind of harden and attain a weirder prominence in middle age is what I'm finding. Maybe not for everybody, but there's a kind of a... sad, like a sorrowful, dislocated feeling.
So I guess looking back then on your own childhood and where you got those experiences to write the song, what would it be that you think you feel like you missed the most from the South and that whole culture that you left behind?
Well, I love visiting there. I mean, one of the greatest things to me about doing what I do and traveling a lot is that I get to return to those places that I love, you know, Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, the upland South, basically. I think it's just embedded in me more than any other part of the United States, and of course the music that I love the best comes from those places too, you know. So that's what I love. I love the music. I love the weather. I love the kind of like the laid back culture, you know, people not getting in your face, hey, fuck you, get out of the way, buddy. You know, there's none of that down there.
Right.
You know, they'll get drunk and hit you, I guess, but they won't.
They won't be in a hurry to do it.
They won't be in a hurry to hit you, right. They'll let you, like, dig your grave a little deeper before they sock you. But, yeah, I like, I just kind of like the tempo of life and the music.
Gotcha, okay. And what do you, I guess, what do you see as the difference now moving forward in generations? You know, you having lived in the city and you know, making your life there. How do you think the experiences of... you know, children would differ from your early life, I guess.
I think everybody seems a little bit richer now, despite the recession, you know. Where I'm at, the kids are kind of, I don't know, it's just a really different, you know, video, for one thing. It's like, you know, something I'm always at odds with my kids. You're always trying to curtail their time. They're always, like, drifting off into this imaginary land of shooting at prostitutes and foreigners on a big screen, and you know, like I can't relate to that at all. Things, I don't know, life seems kind of easier now for my kids, but maybe that's just because, like the guy in the song, that you know, I'm providing more stupid, useless American luxuries for them.
Okay. Well, I think that was definitely kind of the feeling that he had, so I figured that's sort of the feeling you had about your own kids in some ways.
I had a lot of time just to be on my own. I think I was kind of a lonely kid. You know, I was an only kid for a lot of years, mm-hmm. and I had a lot of, you know, I'm sure I had a lot of boredom, but I also had a lot of freedom to wander around, ride my bike, be alone, create imaginary landscapes, write songs, write poetry, write novels, get lost. I had imaginary friends that came and played with me, so I was kind of alone a lot, and you know, and that benefits you in a lot of ways. You know, it's strengthening the imagination, and I think it's a virtue to know how to be on your own.
Okay. And I want to wrap up here because I know you got to get going pretty soon.
Yeah, I blabbed here all night.
Oh, it's all good. I love it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure our listeners do as well. But I do want to touch on just a couple more songs real quick on the album to give people an idea. One I found really interesting was Long I Ride, which is kind of an up-tempo piece, but it's also sort of about the traveling musician. Mm-hmm. And I saw a lot of sort of kind of parallels to your life as well in that. Was that kind of at all an autobiographical idea on that one, or
it's the same? It's like half and half, you know. And I mean, when I set these songs, I try to set them either in places that I've lived, if possible, or at least places that I've been. And even though I've got, you know, a song set in parts of Ireland and Idaho where I actually have spent no time, like that's just a couple of things that I've written. But most they tend to be places I've been. So the guy in that song is in Houston, and then he's in Brooklyn. And, you know, he mentions Norfolk, and where else? I think that might be it.
I think specifically, maybe, yeah.
So, yeah, I've spent, you know, a fair amount of time, and, well, I lived in Brooklyn for a little bit and spent a lot of time in the other two places, so, so in that way, it's autobiographical, but, I hope he isn't as, that I'm not as big an asshole as that guy is. I mean, he's really never content. He just kind of ran, you know. It's a drifting song that has a little bit of an anti-drifter animus in the presentation. That, you know, it tries to strip away some of the glamour from the drifting thing.
Right. Well, I mean, it definitely, I think, gives you an idea that it's not a life for everybody. But at the same time, he's got kind of an attitude about it that, you know, at least makes him seem like a bit of a, I guess, a bit of a philosopher about it in his own mind.
Yeah, it's a philosophical song, and I do endorse his philosophical point of view. You know, when he, the point of the song, Long I Ride, Little I Gain, you know, he's traveling constantly, but he's not really getting anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's a Sinclair Lewis kind of wrote a story called Travel Is So Broadening, and it was kind of a sarcastic title referring to the fact that, you know, you can go all over the world and just be in your own bubble and not learn or really find out anything. So that's kind of the case of that guy. And then when he says at the end that even, you know, no place in the world is kind of good, no place is satisfying of all these places he goes, and he refers to heaven at the end. He's not even looking forward to going to heaven at the end, because you got to die to get there, and there probably won't be, like, girls to have sex with him there. And he's like, what the hell, you know? He's like, nowhere is good enough for him, you know?
I got you. At the same time, though, I think there are some elements that a lot of working musicians can relate to, just in that literally making enough tonight to make it to tomorrow aspect of
just
his life.
Have enough to drink with a little bit left over. Yeah.
Exactly. I know you've probably done a little bit better than that in your
not
own
much.
Career. But well, you said it, not me. But I thought that a lot of you know, musicians or people who are fans of music and understand what it's really like could probably latch on to that as well. So
yeah. I mean, the sort of. Yeah, I think you can hear about any guy's jobs and travails related to the jobs and kind of identify with it. Everybody's got a fucking hard job, you know? Who doesn't? Everybody does. 90% of us.
Well, speaking of that, one more I want to mention, because it actually sort of stands much differently than some of the other songs, which are Migrant's Tale, is Where I Fell, which is actually about a guy who stays put, kind of like you say in the song, right where he fell to earth.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentions the fact that at once he hated his old job, but on the other hand, he really wishes he had it back because it was much better than what he's got now.
Right.
And that sort of whole thing that we can identify with here in the Rust Belt. But what made you want to write a song about somebody who, in many ways, was so opposite to your own life in that respect?
Thanks for listening so thoroughly to these songs. You're actually sort of making me think again about what I was doing. But I think in that song, I've been really impressed. Not possibly impressed, but just impressed by, leaving my community, going on the road. If I go an hour and a half, 2 hours south, just into downstate Illinois, and I see the way that a lot of people are living, it seems like things are more barren and stark and difficult for people in little American towns these mm-hmm. days that are, far from where the half or so of us in big, vibrant towns. I mean, Chicago is a really pretty successful town overall. There's a lot of violence in some neighborhoods, but the part of it that's successful and economically diverse and happy is really working at all those things. And I think that's true of big swaths of, Houston and L.A. and San Francisco and Boston and, 12 other places where millions of people live.
Mm-hmm.
But in these little places where a couple thousand people live, I don't know, it's, after the recession, it seems like the recession hit those places a lot worse than it did my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, it felt profitable to try to put myself into that. Not even myself, really, but just to set a song in that landscape, because I meet a lot of people in those circumstances, and they're not case studies, and they're not depressives, and they're just normal people, like, working it out the best they can. But the means seem more limited in those places.
I've got you. And I think there's also sort of a mythos about the small town that comes through in the sound. I personally, one of the highlights of my life was starting out in Chicago and driving Route 66 all the way out to California, which I think every American should be required by law to do
sure.
by the time they're 30. But you see that sort of small town. Each one is a little bit different than the next, and each one is struggling to get by in its own way. So having grown up in more rural areas, do you still sort of feel like you identify with small town and small town people more than the big city? Or is that in your past now?
I don't know. It seems like in the city there's more a sense of being looked at. You're sized up according to your occupation and the uniform of your occupation that you're wearing. If you're sweeping the street, or if you're serving sandwiches at a counter, if you're pumping gas, or if you got a suit and you're on your way to the law office, your uniform kind of like defines you a lot more in a big city. And so I think you're being sized up, like, pretty constantly when you're living in a big city. I feel comfortable in both places, but it kind of feels more like going away backward, more like going home and being among the kind that I grew up with, I guess, when I go to these places to play and just hang out with people in a little bar and find out what's cooking with them. I love doing it, and I hope not as a Charles Kuralt, reporter taking notes on their thing. But that's kind of what it turns out to be, when you make songs about them. You're kind of like eavesdropping on their situations and fictionalizing them and using them in a way.
Right. Well, I've always felt that if William Shakespeare were alive today, he'd be sitting in a mall just watching people. I think when you are a writer, everybody you run into is a little part of a character. So I can definitely, appreciate that. But just to wrap up here, I want to kind of open it up to you. As far as Gone Away Backward, is there anything else you think people really should know about it, or any song, your other song that you're particularly proud of, that you want to tout, or anything like that?
No, I mean, we haven't talked about the musicians on it, and I would just want to say that there's four of them besides me. Their names are Robbie Gerso, Jenny Scheinman, Ron Spears, and Mike Bubb. And I was fans of all of those guys before calling them and asking them to come do the project. And I've been really, close to Robbie for 20-some years now, working with him a lot and performing with him, and Jenny for several years as well. And the other two just kind of like fans of what they do more than I was just merest acquaintances with both of them. And so that's a really fun part of doing a record, is just casting it. You know, I always love thinking, like, who would play the drums the best on this, or who would play, you know, the fiddle best on this. And so I like the idea that each one of those people sort of sang. Every one of them's a good singer, and every one of them plays more than one instrument pretty well, you know. And so there was a lot of potential for, you know, not just having mandolin on a song, but like, who's going to play the mandolin? Like, who? What does it sound like when you play it or you play it? You know, that happened on the record. And the bassist also played the banjo, so he'd put down the bass, pick up the banjo, another guy would pick up the bass, and, you know, we could do it.
Nice.
We could do it all in and amongst us. And
that's kind of a luxury you don't get very often these days.
It was awesome, yeah. And so we could do everything live, too. You know, if we wanted a banjo, we didn't have to overdub it. So it's great doing a record without overdubs.
Very cool, very cool. Well, I think you did a great job on your selections there, I have to say, because one of the things I definitely mentioned in the review is that I thought the musicianship was superb on the whole album, the whole way through. And don't, you know, undercut your own guitar work, too, because there's a lot of great stuff in there.
Oh, I'm not.
As well. Surely wouldn't want to do that. But, yeah, I definitely want to say for anybody who hasn't heard Gone Away Backward yet, it is definitely an album that's worth checking out, especially if you like sort of that older sound music. Like Robbie said, it's not strictly bluegrass or anything, but it definitely has that feel in it. Definitely all of our listeners, if they get a chance, check out Robbie's new album. It's really worth your time, and I think that you'll put it on a lot of your playlists and listen quite frequently. So I really want to thank you, Robbie, for joining us today.
Yeah, man. Thanks,
it's
Diesel.
Definitely great. No,
it's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Well,
I divulged more than I meant to.
Oh, well.
I'm hoping nobody will hear this.
Yeah, well, we're a small website, so probably nobody will. No. But hopefully you had a good time. We want to thank you again. And I'm really looking forward to the show because, like I said, it's been a good 5 years at least since I've seen you live. So we're going to go in there and listen to you rock some. Cool?
All right.
And this is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett. This has been another edition of No Surf Music's Burning River Fireside Chats. And we're going to go listen to some great tunes. See y'all. This has been a No Surf Music Burning River Fireside Chat. This is your host, Jason D. Diesel Hammett, signing off. Remember, No Surf Music is your source for the best in Americana, alt-country, indie rock, and more. For original reviews and interviews, visit nosurfmusic.com.